So, all right. So I'll have to wait for Scott's book.
Okay.
And oh, but the reason why it caught my attention partly was because one of the things that he said was that he felt like as he got older, he became more annoyed by bad design than inspired by good design.
Okay.
I thought it was interesting because I never feel that way.
Oh, really?
You know, it's like I people often say, you know, does it make you crazy when you go around and you constantly run into bad design problems? And I'm like, no, I know exactly how hard it is to do it right.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so I'm very patient with people, you know, it's like, and I'm really admiring when people do a really good job. So.
Well, that's one of the things I want to talk to you about was because like one of the things I've asked you about before, I just want to, that I still carry to this day was that, because during your speeches, I'm not sure if you still do it or not, but your speeches, you pull people up and you do like a live usability test.
Right.
On that. And I was just like, wow, you're really like flying without a net because you could yep. just, because you also don't like, you pick out the website at random for yep. people to test.
The website's not picked out quite at random.
Okay, well, there you go.
The website is always picked out. The website is always picked out with two criteria. One is that it's something that actually people will be able to follow along who have never seen it before.
Okay.
Because usually when you're doing a usability test, it's your stuff, so you kind of know what's going on.
Okay.
So I want something that's pretty easy to follow.
Okay.
And two, I kind of want something that's not in perfect shape.
Okay.
So there's a reasonable chance that we'll run into something. I don't, you know, suss them out so that they're definitely like majorly flawed, but I want to make sure there's a reasonable chance because it's much more effective.
Okay.
But I do pick the person at random, and I do pick the task kind of right away. And
okay.
Whatever.
Okay. So this is like the magician's secrets you're telling me right now. So that's pretty.
That's the only one because it really does. I mean, we could talk about it. And people asked me years ago at a conference, the first time I mentioned at a conference that I did this, that I tried to live test it. And a lot of people came up to me who were usability people came up to me afterwards and said, like, you're kidding. You really do. Like, you really do that without a net. It's like, I said, it always works.
Yeah. Like, that's what makes it like, because that's what you said. You know, it always works. There's always something to be fixed at least. And yeah. So I always remember that very well. It's just like, there's always something to be fixed. I was like, so we'll never ever have the perfect website. Like, oh.
I'm glad that's what you remembered. That's one of my favorite things.
So. Yeah. Well, it's also a good thing just for like, you know, people who want to speak. It's also kind of like learn just to go on stage and try new things. And also just, you know, you're there to, you know, also another Molly Hostock always says like, if you're there to teach people, then the audience also wants you to win. So don't be afraid.
Right.
Go out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. But, yeah.
Just I love Ask Me Anything's best actually.
Yeah.
I always learn when people ask me questions. I always learn to figure something out. That's actually the meantime when I figure things out.
Yeah.
When people are asking me questions.
Yeah. Because it's always interesting to see what people come up with questions like, oh, I never thought about that.
Right.
And then the trick that Molly also taught me is just, there's the people, the collective intelligence of the people sitting watching you talk is bigger than the person standing on stage talking to them. And that it's okay to ask the crowd if there's a question you can't answer, if anyone has an answer to that. So
yeah, I would approach that from I learned many, many years ago that it's perfectly okay, and in fact very important to say I just don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
I think I'm waiting for my son to get that.
Oh man. How old is your son?
He's 25. Okay. And he's actually in the human interface grad program at Bentley here in Boston this year.
All right.
So
cool.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. What's his name?
Harry.
Harry. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, 20 is like, you know everything, I think. You heard that from the teenage years.
I don't think I learned that one until I was like 34.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I guess we could get started if you want.
Yeah, sure.
Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt. On today's show, we talk with Steve Krug. A highly sought-after speaker, Steve is a usability consultant with more than 20 years of experience as a user advocate for companies like Apple, AOL, Lexis, and many, many others. He is best known for his book, Don't Make Me Think, about human-computer interaction and web usability. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. CSS DevConf 2017 is in New Orleans this October. Early bird tickets are on sale right now at cssdevconf.com. UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com. Set it and forget it with a non-Breaking Space show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, be notified in your inbox by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Find show notes and links discussed in today's episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T, where I try to be witty. I mean, I just try. I really fail a lot about that. So, as always, if you like the show, please tell others to find Nonbreaking Space Show on iTunes. Word of mouth helps us out immensely. Now, on with the show. But yeah, thank you, Steve, for being on the show today. I appreciate it. And so, the author of...
I always find that interesting when that happens, by the way, when I listen to NPR and whatever, when the host says, thank you for being on the show, and then the guest says some variant of, you know, thank you for asking me or whatever. I sort of think if I was ever on with what's her face, Terry Gross, you know, I would say thank you for asking me. I'd say I wanted to do this my whole life.
I think Stephen Colbert, when he was starting out his show in, I think, 2005, I remember this because I was doing my grad paper at the time and fiercely writing it with all by myself in the office. And so I listened to NPR and so he actually had a joke about, like, you know, he actually used that 15 seconds of like thanking him, and he actually had a really great, I forget what he said, but it was like, actually he made a joke about, oh, what should I say? I don't know. And so he did a really great, he landed that very well.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so yes, thank you for asking. Yeah. it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So you're the author of Don't Make Me Think, which is undergone three revisions now, and then also Rocket Surgery Made Easy, which is sort of like a, if I paraphrase it, just let me know if I'm paraphrasing right, how to do usability tests. Is that right?
Yep. It's a little how-to guide. Mm-hmm.
And then the third edition, it has more of an update, more geared towards mobile.
I did. I added a chapter on mobile because that was what people were asking me about, and also it's what people are doing now.
Right. And so you, in there you have a little, I think a screed, I guess, also, if I may, I don't know if that's too harsh of a word, but about mobile first and about you don't like it, about people designing for mobile first, in the sense that mobile first, that people design things for people mobile on the go is... I think you had described it's like, and it turns out that people actually use their smart devices for everything and not just, you know, for things that they would do on the go or people would assume for on the go. Is that?
Except that I wouldn't care. There are any number of things that I can be accused of screening about, but I think that happens not to be one of them. I think there I was more trying to convey what Luke W. says. You know, I mean, Luke W. invented mobile first, invented the whole idea of mobile first. And then it turns out, as he made so clear, the point that you just made, which is that while mobile first is very important, you shouldn't assume that even if you're designing on a mobile device, that means the person's going to be holding it out in front of them walking down the street, that people will use these mobile devices sitting on the couch as much as they'll use them walking around outside. So mobile first more means you've got a limited amount of space and you've got to fit in whatever functionality you can in that much more limited amount of space than a desktop. So mobile first is sort of the idea that you should be very careful and think it through about what really is the most essential about the thing that you're building and build that in first. And then if you have more room on the desktop or wherever, then add in additional functionality, but to be sort of to hone down to the core functionality.
Right.
But yeah, people, the point that you made is something that people do get misled by. They think that mobile first means, everybody's only going to be using these things while they're on the go, and it ain't true. But Luke, if anybody wants to know about mobile, I had a chapter on mobile. If anybody really wants to know about mobile, they should subscribe to anything that Luke W. does, because he's really the best source of wisdom.
Right.
Yeah. About how to design for mobile.
Yeah, definitely agree. I love his tweets, like, especially with his graphics about like
his graphics are so good.
Yeah,
his graphic style is excellent.
Yeah. Yes, they're I think they're painfully good. I feel like
they are. They really are. I've looked at them many times and thought, is there anything I can learn from that? You know, so can I do stuff that's like that? And the problem is that they're a lot of work. Yeah. That's what I learned by looking at them and thinking about. I think he worked really hard on this one. You know, like. He knew exactly what he wanted to say, and he worked hard on getting it right. So, but it is a great style. He evolved a great style. So a few people have.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll talk about mobile some more, and can you get your thoughts about the? You talked about mobile first, and then you also went on to talk about in the book about responsive web design and and if that's his correct, like David's correct, like you think that hurts websites on mobile.
Well, I think it hurts larger websites. You know, I mean, I sort of and this I have. I don't remember honestly what's in the chapter in the book because that was 3 years ago.
Okay,
I could go back and look at it, but I talk about it from time to time, and I try not to get too screedy about it because I have pretty strong feelings about it, which is that I felt like before mobile came along, we had sort of figured out pretty well how to do websites, how to do reasonable size screen websites. That there were we had sort of templates evolved for different types of websites and a lot of conventions that worked really well for how to present information, how to do information architecture, and whatever. And then when people started, and partly it was mobile first, partly people because of responsive design, which is a great idea that you should be able to sort of design once and with some modifications have that same thing work for different size screens. It's really just about screen size. It's not about whether the thing is mobile or not. It's just about screen size. For my money, what happened was people started using these frameworks, okay? Because the frameworks made it really easy to build stuff. The frameworks had responsive design built into them. Okay. So you could basically just plug your stuff into a framework, and it would automatically create it at different sizes for you and be fully responsive and whatever. But from my perspective, what happened was people started doing just mobile sites that worked reasonably well on mobile. They tended to be one-page sites. So everything, almost everything, was on the first page, and you just sort of kept scrolling through the different areas of information. They had really pretty big graphics, even for a small screen. They tended to have pretty big graphics because for some reason that seemed to be a good idea.
Yeah.
And less information. So you had a lot less information density. And then when you looked at it on a desktop screen or on anything larger, even a tablet screen, it didn't change much. All it changed was it got blown up, you know, as opposed to being responsive in a much deeper sense, where you're building once, but you're building things in such that when it's presented in different sizes, it's actually presented in a way that's useful at that size. So, you know, my gripe is that I go to these websites and on my desktop sometimes, and I feel like you could read them from space. There's like so little information density. So I'm scrolling forever on my desktop. I'm scrolling through these huge graphics, and I'm getting very little information. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that's been very good. But on the other hand, if everybody thinks that, see, I don't think desktops are going away. I don't think large screens are going away. Large screens, I think, will continue to exist, or larger screens. Mm-hmm. Continue to exist, even if it's only sort of tablet-sized screens, but those are larger than a phone.
Yeah.
My screed about that is I don't feel like building the thing for a phone as a single-page scrolling site is necessarily a great way to present information. That's all.
Yeah. I think my biggest one of my biggest challenges with responsive design and going from being a designer from like 93 to dealing with the responsive nature is that people do blow up fonts to this huge degree, and that you can definitely read it from space. And it's gone from having to deal with light text on gray backgrounds, where it's like on small text, to like just fire hose of text size. It's just like, yeah. I hope you can read my heading. Like, yeah, your heading is just fine.
I would like a little more information beyond your heading.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and I believe people do scroll if they're interested in scrolling in what you have, but excessively scrolling because you have large fonts. It's just, I find that a big pain, but I feel
we could open up, my argument is at this point, we could open up almost any website. We could open up the mobile version of almost any website and be mildly appalled by its comparative information density and information capacity to present needed information. So, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, in your book, I think you have an example, which is I totally forgot about this website, but because I think I stopped going to it I think it was the CBS News website example, because you have they would have articles spread across six pages or so, and they have have an image associated with the graphic to make it more SEO friendly and visual or whatever, but they use the same graphic on the top of the same page forever for each of the articles. So you would have to actually, in your book, you actually complain that you actually scroll past the same image on every page.
Right. So that was sort of the worst of all possible worlds. They were making you click through successive, instead of doing one long scrolling story, they were making you click through successive pages so they could get ad views.
Yeah.
But stupidly, they don't do it anymore. Somebody wrote me a couple of months ago and said, do you ever go to that site? And I said, not really, but I went and took a look, and they don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Not because of me.
Yeah, I remember you did. And then sometimes you have an example of a good site or a good app. Was it Weatherbug?
Weatherbug is great.
Yeah, I haven't looked. They've updated their site, their app, to a new version with a subscription model now. And it's not as awesome as I think as it used to be, because I used to be a big Weatherbug fan.
So. Yeah, I don't know. I'm confused because I updated at some point, or I had to delete it and reinstall, and it seemed like it came back different.
Yeah.
But then I don't know if I managed to get back an old version or something, because it's still pretty good. Yeah, the other one that I have in the book was Hipmunk.
Yeah.
The travel site, which I just adore.
Oh yeah. It's
such a great thing. I don't know if you ever took a look at it.
I think one of the founders of Hipmunk, or one of the supporters of it, he was in Austin he had a book tour. He's actually Reddit's first CEO or whatever. He had a book tour. He was talking about Hipmunk, and basically Hipmunk turned out to be like one of the people he hired. I'm pretty sure people will tell me like after the episode goes out how wrong I was about who did what. But Hipmunk came about because he was tired of buying plane tickets that no human would want to travel. and so I was like, why would I want a 2-minute layover when I, or an overnight layover? Like, no, I don't want to, if I can avoid that.
Yeah. It gives you the information you want without you having to poke around forever. Yeah. You know, what's their top level? Their default category is agony. Is it? I think, which is like the most reasonable layovers, the most reasonable price, and it's like the least agony is their default view.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a great site. I wish I use it more often, but I don't. So I feel like also this is my pain point. Also, with responsive design, was that Steve Jobs comes out, changes the world with his Apple team and his iPhone, and he shows you New York Times website. It loads just like a web page, like a newspaper page. Right. And it's like, hey, if you want to read this article, just double click it. and so it's like zooms in, like, oh, I can zoom the text. And I was like, that's amazing. That's great. That's awesome. And then responsive design came along. It's like, no, we want to format the page to the screen. I was like, yeah, but we could just double click.
I hate these news sites that basically want to make it look like a magazine.
Yeah,
it's like their idea is that it's far more attractive and appealing somehow to make this look like a magazine. So each story gets a big graphic, an unnecessarily big graphic. And the Washington Post, God bless them at the moment, the Washington Post. And I have three Washington Post apps, and unfortunately, the only one where you can get the view that I want, which is like what you just described, which is where you can scroll down through the stories and you can tap on a story and then zoom into that story. The only one that does that is the one where you subscribe to the DC version of the Washington Post, which costs a fortune. So the one where you get the sort of, you don't get the local DC news in the Washington Post is another app that's one of those dumb magazine views where you're scrolling forever just to scroll through the list and see what stories you might want to read.
Oh man,
it's yeah. All right. Stop being crabby. I'm really not that crabby. In real life, I'm not that crabby. I just rarely get to talk about it.
No problem. That's good. Now, this is like a hit parade of apps and websites. This is bringing on. This roast apps for the next half hour.
Right.
yeah. So like,
I just went through and deleted like 40 apps from my iPhone the other day.
Oh yeah.
That I had tried out at various points and sort of thought, maybe I'll go back and take another look at that interface again sometime. And finally hit the point where I said, never going to do it.
Yeah.
Ruthless.
So I want to talk about, like, I love your books because you talk about, because you break down usability tests and you make them sound so easy to do, which, you know, they are, because you do them, you know, while you're speaking in front of hundreds or, you know, dozens or thousands of people, in your presentations. And so if usability tests are so easy, why do people don't do them as often is my question. It's like,
right.
Why caught up in day-to-day working and.
Well, and you're right. I always do. If I'm speaking for an hour or more, then I will always do start off with a live usability test. I'll spend like 15, 17 minutes dragging somebody out of the audience, having them try doing some tasks on a usability test. I read the script, my usability test script from the book, and do an abbreviated usability test with them, basically just so that everybody in the audience has sat through a minimal usability test, through my idea of how simple a usability test should be. And hopefully some of them get inspired to think, oh, I could do that. He's not doing anything. I could do that. Yeah. And also the other thing is that they work. Every time I do it, they work. That people are sitting there in the eye and saying, holy crap, we just watched it. He spent 6 minutes using the thing and came across a bunch of what, if it was mine, or serious problems that I would think needed to be fixed. So I always do that. I find it very convincing. So why don't people do more of it?
Yeah.
I actually find they are doing a lot more of it. I mean, partly... in some small part, thanks to me, but in a larger part, thanks to the whole Lean UX movement.
Okay.
So I think Lean UX came in on the advent, on the tails of UX becoming, you know, UX was getting more accepted. Well, all right, here's the timeline, which I've actually never thought about or cataloged before. But okay, so 2007 or whenever it was, Steve Jobs, you know, gives birth to the iPhone, fully blown. Mm-hmm. And does what I always call the full bore case study for the idea that you can make money by creating things that are easy to use. Okay, so case studies of usability are hard to do. It's always, you know, it's tough to, it takes a lot of work to do one, but he did one that was so convincing. I mean, every CEO out there said, "Holy cow!" You know. He made it easy to use. He went to the trouble of making it easy to use, and by golly, people liked it, and they paid money for it. So maybe there's something to that. So that was just such a huge boost to UX in general. And then a couple of years later, the Lean people out of the whole Silicon Valley, we have to figure out how to make money off of this movement, whether we know what we're doing or not. Actually had some very smart people who picked up on that and said, okay, so you need to get out of the building. You need to actually do rapid prototyping. You need to have people try use what you're building, whether it had anything to do with minimum viable product or not. It basically, the part that was most useful to me was that they basically said, you can't just sit around and think that you know how to do this. You've got to be generating something and watching people try and use it, which is usability testing. So that was a huge boom. So I think that as a result of all of that, mm-hmm. that there are a lot more people doing usability testing than there ever were, like a lot more. And I get the email to prove it. And also Don't Make Me Think gets used an awful lot in courses. I'm shocked at how many courses it gets used in, and that the people who are teaching those courses, some of whom we've been in touch with, are having people do usability tests. So people, even in the classroom environment, more and more people, and people write me after the fact and tell me this, that's where they learned it, are doing usability tests. So I think that's spreading by leaps and bounds. Now, why doesn't it get done all the time? Because it requires effort. it's original sin, maybe that's the answer. I don't know. It takes work, you know. And even though it's more valued now, and it's much easier to convince your boss that there may be some benefit in spending some time with users and having them try using out your prototypes and whatever. It still takes time that people don't necessarily have. You know, I mean, everybody in this business is a day late and a dollar short. You know, it's like nobody is anywhere near doing what's on their plate as it stands. So the idea of adding anything more is always been a problem. So honestly, it's kind of much further than I would have thought. Years ago, I said that quite confidently, which I shouldn't have because I'm always wrong about the future, that usability was never going to get to be a budget line item in software projects the same way that marketing is or any of the things that are firm line items, that it might creep up a little bit, but then it would get thrown overboard again at the first sign of recession. Honestly, I think UX and usability now is getting much closer to being a kind of standard line item in any development project. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I really didn't think it was going to happen. And I think it was Steve Jobs that did it, basically.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Whatever Dirksen said, you can make a billionaire and a billionaire pretty soon. You're talking real money.
I mean, like, if you just look at Apple's Circle UFO campus that they're building, you know, just like, it's like that's a testament to having a good idea at the right time but making it useful. I mean, because, and that all started because MP3 players were just terrible. They're absolutely terrible.
Yeah, really. Think back to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, will that fly, actually, that building? Is that the secret behind it that actually will fly?
Probably. I think it's a click wheel. It's an homage to the click wheel. That's what I think. And you just press down a certain part of the building, and like you get a nice song plays out.
So it's skeuomorphic then.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was reading, there was some article the other day about that dredging up that the original prototype of the iPhone was basically had the iPod interface, you know, with wheel and whatever. It's just kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the iPod came out, and I think it was like the click wheel. I think the click wheel took a lot of. I don't know if it was the iPod or the click wheel version or the new iPhone that Generation 1 came out, but the instructions were so short. It was like a card, and maybe it was like three. You know, it was a fold out. Maybe like it was three things or whatever. And I remember developers. You know, a boss would come in and to say, our product needs to be this good that it only needs that much instruction. And I was like, well, it's we run a financial app, so I'm not really sure you can do that. So, but the influence was there for sure. So, yeah.
Right. Wrong influence, but the influence, that's good.
Yeah. I was like,
I thought a lot because I work with some very complicated apps, and it's like, you know, you can't make this that easy. You know, it's foolish to think that you can.
Yeah. And then about being in the wrong about the future so many times is like one of the things we have in one of our conferences is we do a QA panel with our speakers and with the audience. And so then, and it's like, you can ask me anything you want and, you know, and I moderate it. But my one rule is that you cannot ask a question about what do you think of the future of XYZ? Because one, it's going to be wrong. Two, it's impractical for you to walk out this door and understand what's going to happen. And three, it's going to be really wrong. So,
right. Yeah. I actually had that in the introduction, even for the first version of Don't Make Me Think, I had that in the introduction.
Yeah.
It was like things not present at time of photo, the things you won't find in this book, was my conjectures about the future, because the only thing I knew about the future was that it wasn't going to be what people think it is.
Yeah.
That we were going to be surprised. Whatever turned out to be important was going to be things we were surprised by.
And then in your book, you saw like six maximums. And you boil it down to six maximums. And you say a morning a month for usability testing.
Right.
Right. Start earlier than you think. Makes sense. Yep. And that's like start as soon as you can do a paper prototype. Is that right?
Yep. Or a sketch on a napkin. Yeah.
Okay. And then is it grade on a curve? Is that right? Or what's
recruit the loosely and grade on a curve, which is that's the weakest of all maxims, but I can go into that at length. But it's I don't want to talk about politics, but like certain politicians, it doesn't say exactly what it means. Mm-hmm. If that was there to persuade people not to get discouraged by the difficulty of recruiting. So to say that basically when you're starting off doing usability testing before you've done much of it and your stuff is still very rough, that you don't need to be too fussy about recruiting people who are directly from your target audience, because your problems are so gross that anybody, you can talk people through, you can give them a helping hand through the interface, and it will still immediately become obvious to you where the problems are. So recruiting can be the hardest part, or it's the most sort of effort, labor intensive part sometimes for people, especially when you're starting out and you haven't done it before. So that was basically there to say, don't let the difficulty of recruiting keep you from testing. That feel free to test with almost anybody. And the grade on a curve was to say, okay, when somebody runs into a problem, if they're not somebody from your target audience, then just ask yourself, did they have this problem because they're not from a target audience, or would people from our target audience probably have had this problem anyway? And it turns out you can answer that question pretty legitimately and easily. Yeah. So that's sort of the weak sister of the maxims. And I'm trying to figure out how to revise it if I do a version.
Well, I think it's pretty good. I think it's in terms of getting up.
It's helpful because people do give up because they have a hard time recruiting.
Yeah.
You asked before, why do people not test more? I think recruiting is probably up there at number one or number two.
Right. Yeah, I can definitely see, because I know if you're in San Francisco or New York or a big metropolis, it's probably easy to get people to do usability testing in your demographic, if you will. Yeah. But if you're like not in those type of cities, or it'd be hard to get people to come in. And so,
right.
And then that's one thing you mentioned in the book is like, you can do remote testing, and you actually talk about remote testing, but you always ask, just make sure you do a couple, live usability testings before. And that's the idea, just to get an experience of what testing is.
So that you're comfortable with the process, really. I mean, people have discovered that remote testing works fabulously well, that you don't really have to be sitting next to the person for most of these things. And that you can get just about the same results by using screen sharing with somebody and doing a remote test. But the only the caveat that I had for it is don't start off doing that. Do some where you're sitting next to the person live until you feel like you've got the routine down, until you've got the script down, and you should know what the moving parts are and what you're going to do next and how you talk to the person. Because when you're doing it remotely, you actually do have to sort of pay more attention to how they're doing, because you don't have all the visual cues of them sitting next to you. So you want to be sure that you're pretty comfortable doing the process. But it doesn't take that long. I mean, I would say if somebody does, like two rounds of three people in person, then they should feel free to go ahead and try doing remote tests. It doesn't take that long to learn either.
Okay, cool. Awesome. And then the next one is make it a spectator sport.
Spectator sport is probably my favorite,
because
where you get the benefit out of it is having the people on your team and anybody, whether they're stakeholders or bosses or whatever, having them actually watch some usability tests. It's so much better than having some expert go off and do a usability test and come back and write a report. The live experience of watching somebody try to use your product is very informative and moving. It changes people. It changes their understanding of who the users are, and it changes their understanding of what the product is and what it's good for. So that's like my favorite, is get people to come and watch in person as much as put bodies in the seats. And there are all these other benefits of it that, you know, there's the crosstalk that goes on while people are watching it.
Yeah. Cause like one of the things we do a lot of conferences online and in person, and it's always, someone always asks like, how can I get buy-in from my boss for this amazing XYZ technology or technique that you talk about, because it'll cost money or time or some other resource. And so one of the things I liked is the Brad Frost Atomic Design book that he just came out with. He actually has a whole chapter on trying to get buy-in, because he goes to it. And basically, and what I like about the spectator sport is you get your bosses, you get your colleagues involved, and there's no hiding from the results, right? Like they can say like, oh, we don't have the resources to do XYZ. We don't, you know, I don't want to do it. Whatever they can couch that phrase and however they like, we don't have the resources or time. But when they see like there's something painfully wrong with the site, right, there's no like hiding from it. And your boss sees it, your colleague sees it. Like, we need to address these issues. And so it makes it so much easier to get that buy-in that way from those. And so, so Brad's, you know, he does a lot more things, but you know, the, if I can oversimplify it, is that to ask for forgiveness is basically his approach to it. So,
it's true. And people who do usability tests for years, all the ones I know, they often talk about it as like a conversion experience, that you'll see people come in and watch their first usability test and you see their eyes light up. They're like, wait, I've never watched anybody try and use our stuff before. That's what it's really like. Oh my God, we should be doing more of this. You know, it's really a big thing. The other thing is that people used to create, you know, highlight reels, where the whole idea was to create a video that you could show to your boss that would show people being miserable using the product, supposedly convince the boss that money should be spent on it. But it's just not the same as watching it live. It's just not the same at all.
Yeah, because
my favorite tip is if you are not yet doing usability testing and you want to try and get people started, which actually is happening a lot. I mean, I feel like there are a ton of people out there who are the person in their organization or their department who's interested in UX, who sort of believes in UX, and they're trying to figure out a way to get their boss to let them do some of it, or, you know. And so my favorite tip is, do a usability test of your competitors. So announce that next Wednesday we're going to bring in three people and we're going to have them do the tasks they would do on our site on our two competitors. And you'll get people to come, because everybody wants, it's schadenfreude, everybody wants to see how badly the competitors are doing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also, there's no penalty for it, in that your stuff is not going to look bad, you know? So nobody on your team has to worry about the fact that the boss is going to look at it and say, oh, well, our stuff is crap, right? You know? And I have had people report back to me that this actually is the best way to get started, you know, that everybody wants to see how the competitors are doing, because they assume that you're doing okay, right? And they sort of hope that the competitors are doing really badly.
Okay. And then also, you also mentioned to have good snacks.
Snacks, yes. Well, and that's part of make it a spectator sport, because I think the best way to get people to come in person is to have good snacks. So I always tell people, if you have any money to spend it on on the $3 chocolate croissants and the really good gourmet pizza during your debriefing session.
Okay.
You know, get better snacks than people can get, and develop a reputation that your usability tests have better snacks than any other meetings in your organization.
I was going to ask you, what do you qualify as good snacks? Because I think you're kind of vague in the book about what makes good.
I am vague in the book, because I think it's an age specific and regional and whatever thing. But okay. Generically, I think I don't think Fiji water really counts for more than you know, local water. But I do think really good pastries are very popular, and there is such a thing as a difference between an ordinary pastry and a really good pastry, and the difference is price. and the same thing with pizza. You know, there's a pizza place near you that everybody really likes better than the other pizza places. You know, it's got really good stuff.
Gotcha.
But that's a matter of taste. I'm trying to dictate.
Okay, cool. I was kind of curious because that was kind of vague. I was like, oh, well, he's...
I like a good chocolate croissant myself, but yeah. That's... but.
Well, you are making me hungry right now, so I guess I'll... So the next maxim is focus ruthlessly on a small number of the most important problems. And right. I find that that's actually refreshing as well, because, you know, you do your usability test, and then let's just say you're like, oh my gosh, there's like a ton of problems to do. You also, in your book, you actually document, you know, a good way to run a meeting, which is crazy that you have like a great usability book about how to run a usable meeting. and I thought that was really awesome. But basically, so you narrow it down to like the top three problems that you need to fix right away.
Your objective, you're having a debriefing meeting. Where it goes back to is the fact that it's so easy to do usability testing and come up with 10 pages for each person of notes of problems that they saw. Mm-hmm. And you have some kind of meeting where supposedly it gets decided what's going to get fixed. But it's very likely that at the end of that process and at the end of the process fixing things, that there are going to be the most serious problems probably will not have been fixed. There are reasons why the most serious problems don't get fixed. You know, things like people assume that they're so serious that if we could figure out how to fix them, we would have fixed them already, you know? And they may have to do with legacy software, and they may have to do with this and that. So my experience is, and Caroline Jarrett in the UK and I did a presentation years ago about this, about why serious usability problems don't get fixed. And so there are a lot of reasons, but so I think it's important that you focus ruthlessly, as the maxim says, on the most serious problems and fix those first. And so I did. I came up with a whole methodology, which partly consists of the people who are the observers in the meeting get a sheet to write the most serious problems are. So at the end of each of the three participant session, they get to write three problems that they observed during that participant session that they thought were the most serious. And so they have maybe nine problems that's on that sheet. And that sheet is what they take into the debriefing session. They're fully entitled and welcome to keep a dozen pages of notes about other things. But for the debriefing session, you want to try and funnel it into, here's what we as a group who observed it agree are really the most serious problems. Whether we think we can fix them or not, these are the most serious problems. And so these are what we should focus on fixing. And I've had people report back that actually worked. That's actually very helpful, because it's so easy to get distracted by low-hanging fruit, you know.
Right.
And serious problems can be difficult. And so the other part of that maxim that's actually not a maxim is – oh, wait. Or is it a maxim about tweaking?
Is it when fixing problems always do the least you can do? Or
yeah. That's okay. So it is a maxim. Right. I told you I forget. Is that if you've got a really serious problem, then the assumption is that if it's a serious problem, then it's going to take a lot of work to fix it. Whereas what I encourage is to say, okay, we have this serious problem that we observed. We observed that somebody was having this specific kind of problem with search, and that it was devastating, and that actually would keep them from using our product. Okay, so what I try and encourage people to do is to say, don't figure out how you can fix search. Okay, which is the usual temptation, is to say, all right, well, our search really sucks, so we got to revise it. Instead, take that specific problem and figure out what's the smallest change that you could make to the interface or the process or whatever that's going to reduce the probability of that being a problem for people, or reduce the probability of being a serious problem. And my take on it is that there's always some tweak that you can make, which, while not a perfect fix, and you may have to hold your nose a little because it's not a perfect fix, will actually greatly diminish the seriousness of our likelihood of that problem. You know, so I'm in favor of tweaking as opposed to coming up with perfect fixes.
Yeah, and then that's I think another thing is, like you mentioned, is that I think also heard from Jared Spools, like, don't do redesigns if you can avoid it.
Yeah, and it's very tempting. It's one of the things that happens when you've just watched three usability tests. You're thinking redesign because your mind is, you know, is overflowing with, oh, this could be better, this could be better, this could be better, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you really are tempted to think what we need is a redesign. Whereas what you need to do is to, as quickly as possible, fix the things that are causing people problems right now. Right. you know, you're welcome to redesign 6 months from now or a year from now, but in the meantime, you can't wait for that redesign to kind of cut down those problems down to size.
Right. Yeah. So I'm doing research right now about legacy sites. So when I talk about legacy sites, I mean like sites that are fixed width. And if you were to follow Steve Jobs in 2007 or whatever, the websites wouldn't be a problem because they could just double click on the different sections and blow it up. Right.
I love that. By the way, when you said that, I love that. I remember going from my first, it actually had a screen because it was what was the phone? Oh, what was the little PDA? A Pilot. So it was a Pilot became a phone, right? There was a phone that was based on the Pilot.
Yeah, the Palm Pilot. Phone.
Yeah. I can't think of what the name of it was, but it had a screen and worked really well. And I remember going from that phone to the iPhone and where you could magically resize things in the browser, where you could tap on stories in the browser and have the column would automatically fill the column. That was like so wonderful.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, you know, and I think we're like minds about that because I just felt like when responsive design came along, and I was like, okay, let me get this straight. You want me to build four websites instead of just one because people can't double tap. Right. It's like, right. And I was just like, oh, okay, it's seems weird. I guess we could do that. There's a lot of issues. I've come around a little bit just in terms of because it's bringing a lot more focus on content, making sure people have the good content strategy and doing all sorts of things to focus on that. So it sort of actually makes better websites. I think people just focus on the mobile part of it. But at the same time, it's like, what the heck? So I'm researching how to convert a legacy website that they don't have the budget or the time to go to responsive design. And so it's kind of calling it retrofitting websites in terms of that. So basically trying to do like small wins and to make sure people it renders into as many devices as possible. Right. Without having to do that. So because I found that to do responsive design, you really have to blow away the legacy sites and actually start from scratch, because it is just a pain in the butt to actually retrofit and actually have that be your site. It's great if you don't have the time to do it and to build a web responsive design, but you need to get some quick wins in order to get to fill the tablet space and some of that too. So, I totally. That's where my mind is right these days, is trying to talk about that and how to solve those problems for sites that can't generate or donate a budget for responsive design, because redesigns are tough.
They're tough. And if you're going to go back and sort of make it responsive from scratch, then you're probably going to start with a framework and you're probably going to do the same kind of thing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And then, it's bad. You talk about a mobile testing unit. I forgot what the name of it was, but you just, we had someone from MailChimp at a conference and did something kind of similar, but basically just like tie a webcam to a clip onto a device. I forgot the name of it. What we called, do you remember the name they called it? Contraption.
It was from, it was from the movie with Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis. And quite honestly, here's a dirty little secret, which I will announce publicly. I don't think I've ever announced it publicly. Brundlefly.
Brundlefly. Okay.
Right. It was from The Fly.
The Fly. Okay.
Where he turns into this, half fly, half person. Yeah. So it's sort of. And the dirty little secret is that while I did a prototype of this, because I thought somebody should be doing these, and I said in the book that I would put the instructions for how, if you wanted to make one, I'd put the instructions for how to make one on the site, but I never did because I had so much to do. And I've had like three people write me over the years and say, gee, where are those instructions? So rather than spend a week putting those instructions together, I have sent email to those three people. Which I consider that a useful tweak. Consider that the right way to do.
Right. Well, it goes back to it takes time to write and to update our blogs, and then rather than easier just to email people who ask.
We're gonna go there. Yeah. and actually, the Brundlefly wasn't even that bad because I put most of the directions sort of in the all I would have had to do was to take a bunch of photos with my phone of the various steps. But this is how stupid we can be. I wanted to be able to tell people what size screw they should buy at Home Depot to screw the two pieces together, which meant I had to go to Home Depot and find the screw, and I could never bring myself to do that step.
Okay.
And I never did it.
Well, to be totally honest, I get lost in Home Depot, so I could tell you for like, I'm gonna go to Home Depot. I can't just go to Home Depot. I have to go to Home Depot, get lost,
right,
and then find what I'm looking for, and then go back out and try to find my breadcrumb trail back out.
I always ask somebody.
Yeah.
I look for a long time, but then I ask somebody, and they're very helpful.
I will say, like, this, speaking of Home Depot, the best thing Home Depot ever did was have pickup, like, order, buy online at your local store, and they say, hey, this guy who doesn't want to spend hours wandering your shelves wants these items, just put them to the front counter, so when he walks in, he doesn't have to, like, go crazy looking around. And so I've walked in buying just screws and walk back out because I just don't. I do not want to go past the 20 feet into the store.
I've never used that. Quite honestly, I'm at the opposite end of the user spectrum, because I actually like wandering around, because inevitably when I'm wandering around, I see something else and I think, oh, I could probably use that someday. Yeah. Not that I would know where to go back and look for it, but I would know that it existed.
Yeah, exactly. See, and then you might, you fall for the trap where you actually might buy it and then have nowhere to put it in your garage. And like, well, I was just mentioned earlier, like we talked about how hard it is to blog and keep a web online presence up to date and stuff like that. So it's like, so I have all these blogs, but I have all these blog ideas I want to keep on writing and updating. And so just push them out there. But I was like, I have to sit down and make sure I don't have any typos, because that submarines your whole like point that you're making, because someone's going to be a grammar Nazi and tell you like you dropped a preposition, like, oh, sorry. So that's always true.
You could just ignore them. I'm capable of that at this point. I'm really capable of that. But yeah, no, I do not spend the morning reading something that I've printed out or the Times at Starbucks when I don't have something that I think, that'd be a really good little blog post. Like, not a morning, I don't think, goes by. Mm-hmm. And yet, my last blog update was in 2014, I think, that. And I lately, for the last year, I have thought of doing an experiment, which I would call the week of blogging dangerously. So basically, that I would just blog for a week, and I would do there would be sort of no particular filter on it.
Yeah.
It could be anything that I thought might be, if it was two sentences that I thought might be worth posting up there, and completely, pretty much unfiltered, and not worrying about getting it all right. And I liked the idea of that experiment, but not enough to actually do.
That would be fun. Yeah, I think that's what you might get, like, a ton of clicks. I don't know.
I might.
Yeah.
I might. It's definitely possible.
Yeah, that's one thing about also talking about. I just, I wish more people would blog, but then I also feel like I should probably set the example and actually blog more before I point people out, like, yeah, you should blog. But
I think more than enough people blog, honestly. I mean, I can't keep up with reading. I only follow a small number of people on Twitter. I'm very lucky. I have a lot of people following me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever see Galaxy Quest?
Yeah.
I feel like when the ship is going through the meteor field in Galaxy Quest, and it turns out the meteors or whatever they are magnetic, and so they're all getting dragged along behind the ship. I sort of feel like that sometimes with that. There are all these people who are following me on Twitter, and I try and respect it by not tweeting very much. But I don't follow very many people, because I follow a small number of people who always tweet stuff that I'm interested in. But even that's like too much to read, even that. So I don't know how people do it who follow a whole bunch of people. Right. They're young, I guess. That's it. They're kids.
Well, that's a whole another topic for information overload. But that's nothing. Like I feel like we talked about this with Simon and St. Laurent from past shows, is that like I do post things on Twitter and Facebook, but I feel bad because that's, you know, Twitter's open, but it's like Facebook's a walled garden, and that all this content is for their, it's in their archive. It's in, it's, you can't really export it out that I've seen easily. So, but so all this content about what I'm thinking or whether people are coming in on, which used to be back in the day with blogs, people would have their own blogs, WordPress comment systems, and we were just, you know, ping ping, and we get notified when people post stuff. And so yeah, there was this era of like personal blogging that was really great, but now it's, you know, now it's you know, it's, and you know, people still blog, you know, whatever, but it's not, it wasn't the same as it is now. So it's and so that's where I feel like, you know, a little shame, because I feel like I should be back on my site and I should push it out to Facebook and to Twitter as needed. So that's
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
you have my imprimatur.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
My ear absolved.
Right. Cool. Awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to close it. Now, like I've been absolved. I think this is like really what I came here for. But
I can help. I'm very glad.
Cool, Steve. How can people find you on the internet? And
oh, I'm way too easy to find. My website is sensible.com, sensible.com. I actually managed to get an English language word, a nice English language word as my domain name many years ago, which nobody seems to want to pay me a fortune for. I've always been surprised nobody's offered me a ton of money for sensible.com. So that's my website. I am on Twitter, and I do tweet, you know, like maybe 5 or 6 times a week. I try and keep it slim, lean, at S Krug, S-K-R-U-G. And, that's about it. I not on LinkedIn because I'm way too easy to find anyway. And, I always feel bad because I get all these requests from people. These LinkedIn requests from people that come from LinkedIn, not from them. So they, you know, it's like, so you can't reply to those emails.
Yeah.
So I have all these people who think that I'm just rude or don't like them because I never reply to their LinkedIn request because they never assume that I'm not on LinkedIn.
Yeah. I just feel bad about that. Yeah. I always feel bad because I think LinkedIn does it on purpose because they have a list of like, so you say like, hey, this person's okay to be my LinkedIn network. And it's just like, hey, do you know these people? And that might be also in your circles or whatever. And and then their button for connect is also very similar to invite as well in terms of
really?
Yeah. And so so there's a person that you know, I know very well, but he's not on LinkedIn. Yep. And I almost like, oh wait, he's on LinkedIn. Like I should, of course I should know this guy. And I always, this happens every time he comes up, it's like, oh, I'll just push it. Like, no, it's his invite. Like, I don't want to know that guy. He's got a million things, other things to do with his life. I don't want him like, oh, you must sign up for LinkedIn. Like, well, if you survived without it so far, like more power to you. Just keep on going. Don't let me drag you down by like the meter and Galaxy Quest. That's just terrible. So
definitely, that's a dark pattern right there.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, thank you again for being
on the show. Let me say first, it's been a pleasure.
Okay.
I'll preempt you.
Okay. This is the end of the NBR bit right here. It's like, thank you. Cool, but yeah,
that's right. That's where you balls.
Cool, awesome. Well, thank you so much, and I hope we talk to you soon and see you in person.
At the conference. Hopefully, one of these days we'll get around.
Yeah.
How is the two things? One, the proportions on my video. Do you want me to switch that to Rita 2 or something? It's kind of
it's fine where it was. If you want to test around, if you want to like
twist. No, I wouldn't mess with it if we don't have to. And the other is the audio. I have a Sennheiser Madonna mic, which will completely isolate from the audio, but I think it's probably pretty well isolated now.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, this is actually a pretty good connection right now. I mean,
yeah. No, at least it's a webcam that I use, an external webcam, but it has a great microphone in it. So.
Okay, awesome. Well, if there's an issue, I'll let you know.
Okay.
But yeah, so far so good. I know with the Google Hangouts, I do want headphones because the Google tries to do so many things on its own to make sure things are great that it actually kind of kills itself in the process.
Don't do me any favors.
Yeah. Right. So it's like, you're being too smart. You know, yeah. Very good.
I read Hangouts. I read GoTo Meeting at like a 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And WebEx is a 9 or a 10. And then Skype is about a 6 and Google Hangouts is like a minus 2.
There was a period of time, like 2-4 years ago, like I could not have a meeting with someone without it being a Google Hangout. You know?
I used to have to fight really hard because I hated it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't, you know, and I'm not a big Google Calendar person and some of that too. So I was just like, I had to learn Google Hangouts and then 1 year we decided to go to conferences that we would never ever go to just to learn new things and see how people. One, like, you know, it's a kind of business thing where like learn how people run conferences, but also learn things that we'd never learned before and like new ideas. So we actually went to the YouTube conference for YouTubers in LA and it just floored me. One, there's like so many tweens and people using YouTube. Really? It really amazed me. Yeah. And then, and then that just, it kind of forced me like this YouTube. These kids will never know. I've grown up without commercials, in a traditional sense. Now they have YouTube commercials, but they've never like the 2 minute block, 3 minute block of commercials.
Yep,
you know, that's a problem.
Yep.
And then they all have great hair. It's all like perfection hair. I was like ready to be on camera at moment's notice. And then there's people who are TV stars that we know of, like TV or movie stars, would kill to have the fan base that some YouTube stars have. And I was just like, I walked down the hall and all of a sudden people would be screaming, there'd be a wave of tweens screaming for these stars that they saw in the hallway, in the conference hallway. And I was just flummoxed. I learned a lot by just going to that conference.
Yeah, that's a great idea to go to conferences you don't go to though.
Yeah. I mean, so.
I've never had any actual live connection with the whole Google, that whole Google world. I was just reading today because they announced they're killing the 22nd the 32nd uncancelable commercials. Mm-hmm. They're not going to offer them as an option anymore to advertisers.
Wow.
But there was also this thing about who Tweety Pie. Mm-hmm. This is one of the biggest people.
Yeah.
There was an article about how basically so many of those people who are Google stars, that so much of what they talk about is Google and how badly Google treats them and how not making the money that they should make. And they can't stop talking about it.
Right. Well, then it's also Facebook is making inroads into video, but they don't have the ad platform that Google does for videos. So basically they were talking about how like Facebook just basically kind of steals, air quotes, their videos and puts it on Facebook's platform. And therefore a video that would get like, that gets millions of hits on Facebook, they don't see one dime of it. If it's a video on YouTube. Yeah. So
there's just too much to keep up with. There's way too much to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was really weird. And then it was also weird. Just, I don't know if you want to talk about YouTube conferences or not, but it was just weird to see how they consider what is a workshop and what you learn from a workshop and what our web industry traditionally considers a workshop. And I think I learned more from web workshops the thing I learned, like I was researching this interview and how you said like let's talk about it right now, but it's just that there's no, the quote that you have is like, there are a few absolute truths in UX design. Yeah. And then that's a great quote. So I would like to know what few absolute truths there are. That'd be great. But so I know. But you also mentioned like, it depends, and how like everyone just says like, oh, we should, it depends. And for YouTube, it's for people who want to also be YouTube stars. And I think Ari, my partner, mentions also is that I think a lot of people who, kids who watch YouTube stars see that they can make a career just by being a YouTube star now, which is totally true. You know, be what you want to be, but I feel like they think they can document everything about their lives and post online, and therefore they'll be YouTube stars. And I just feel like that's not going to be possible for a lot of people. because you know, if you don't live in a, and if not doing, living in an interesting town, doing interesting things, maybe it's, that's not going to be a thing to do. But I don't want to tell someone that their dreams are dead. But
yeah, there are probably massive numbers of them doing it. I would imagine.
But yeah.
Never go there. So.
All right. But I'd say like it depends. And so the thing about YouTube, like, I was going to finish this one thought. It's that so people would always ask every panel I was in was that, how do I get to be like famous like you? Everybody's like, what do you do that works rather than someone else who doesn't work? Which is like a totally honest question to ask. Right? And this was even the workshop. The answer was be authentic. I was like, okay, what does that mean? Like, well, you have to be like true to yourself. Like, well, you know, there's hard work to do what you do, and you can just talk about the hard work, and no one's going to be begrudge you, but no one wants to talk about the hard work.
When you're in your 20s, no.
Yeah.
No, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's like my favorite old joke is in Hollywood, the most important thing is the sincerity. If you can fake that, you're golden.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's a great quote.